On a beautiful Tuesday in the Delaware Valley, this is Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. And yes, it is gorgeous today. But let me tell you, more than half of Rutgers University's faculty, they've hit the picket lines despite the weather. This after months of negotiations with university officials and no contracts. We'll dig into this historic strike in just a few minutes.
Then later in the hour, you might have seen some of these recent headlines about alcohol consumption and your health. There's emerging research that says the one glass a day habit might not be as innocuous as you think. So we brought in an expert, Pitt Professor Christina Mayer, to talk about what we are learning.
Yeah, and April is Alcohol Awareness Month. So call us and weigh in on your drinking habits. Are you like me and thought, hey, a glass of red a day keeps the cardiologist away? Share your thoughts. Will this new research cause you to rethink how much you drink? Our number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2 at whyy.org. And that's 2 like the number. We're looking forward to hearing from you. Now to the news roundup. Avi, I know you've been chomping at the bit for this one. Go ahead.
Okay, so here's where we're going to start. We're going to start with this news about Philadelphia mayoral candidate Jeff Brown. He's the grocery store dude. And this pack that the city board of ethics alleges he has been illegally coordinating with. I know you are hearing this topic, campaign finance, money, PACs, blah, blah, blah. Your eyes are glazing over.
Yes.
I can hear it. But I'm going to make the case that you should try to care about this topic. Mm-hmm. So what the Board of Ethics is alleging is that basically this PAC, which is called For a Better Philadelphia, and which can raise bundles of money, well beyond traditional limits, has been coordinating illegally with the Jeff Brown campaign. And the Board of Ethics sued them to get them to stop. And there was a hearing yesterday. And right now, the status is that they've basically pushed this decision back a couple weeks, and they're going to make a final decision later. But things are sort of like at an injunction standstill for now. The Board of Ethics, the guy who runs it, the executive director, made some pretty spicy comments on that, including saying it was a very well-planned, well-executed scheme to circumvent the contribution limits. Basically saying this wasn't a whoopsie. This was a plan to break the rules. And what they also basically said, I'm paraphrasing here, is that we could have kept fining these people, Jeff Brown and this super PAC, but the fines were in the thousands, and they were raking in millions. So what incentives do they actually have to stop? The only thing we can do is sue them and, in essence, give them one bad news cycle of coverage, a little egg on their face. That's the only hammer we really have here. And I think people should be concerned about that. If the Board of Ethics is saying we really don't have the tools that we need to stop people from breaking rules. Of course, this is all alleged, Cherry, but I thought it was a pretty stunning admission and statement from the Board of Ethics.
Yeah, and you had another big issue with this, and I want to kind of tee this up. Because the lawsuit included allegations that a Philadelphia sports team gave hundreds of thousands of dollars to this PAC. And the lawyer running the PAC has done consulting works for the Sixers. That's per reporting with the Philadelphia Inquirer. And this raises concerns because we all know that the new stadium that is proposed to happen on the right adjacent to Chinatown in Center City, Philadelphia, has been a major point of contention between certain groups. And if there is some PAC money or money being funneled into a PAC that is openly supporting one candidate, could there be some influence over that candidate because of this large amount of funding?
So we should clarify, we don't know that the Sixers were one of the major funders of this PAC. We just know a sports team did it. However, there are clear threads connecting the Sixers to the PAC, including the fact, like you said, the lawyer running the PAC has done consulting work for
the
Sixers.
But we don't know.
We don't know for sure. But let's imagine that the Sixers poured a lot of money into this PAC for Jeff Brown, and more or less, we're trying to pick their candidate because they know that whoever the next mayor is will have a tremendous amount of say in whether an arena gets built. Now, there's nothing wrong with a corporation, a union, an influence group saying, hey, we prefer this candidate over another, so we're going to give them money. I mean, that's how the system works. Maybe we can have that conversation another day. But, Cherry, The difference is that, for instance, if a teachers union gives money to a candidate, the voter can say, well, I like the teachers union or I don't like the teachers union, right? And they can determine whether or not to vote for this candidate. Unless this lawsuit had been filed, we would have never known that potentially the Sixers were throwing a lot of money behind Jeff Brown. And so you could have voted for Jeff Brown not knowing that. And that is a huge issue. This is all dark money. The only reason it came to light is because of this lawsuit.
And I'm going to say one more thing because we got to move on. The impact is multifold. We already know a lot of money has already been spent. And it's allowed Jeff Brown as a candidate to have a big advantage over other less well-funded candidates. In fact, Maria Quiñones Sanchez suspended her campaign over the weekend, and she cited the influx of cash into the race as one of the reasons. So we'll leave it there. We could spend the whole time talking about this. It's a big deal.
Just care about it. I'm just asking people to care about it. I'm not saying who you should vote for or whether the arena should get
built.
Just care about it.
And so since we're on the topic of politics, Bob Casey, Senator, has said that he will seek a fourth term. He announced his decision to seek re-election yesterday. He is already the longest serving Democratic U.S. Senator in Pennsylvania history. And he's likely, you know, a boost for Democrats since Casey has the power of the incumbency. But also there was a tweet that just happened this week saying that Doug Mastriano, it hasn't been confirmed yet, but he's featured in this what looks like a campaign video announcing his throwing his hat into the race as well. So we'll see if Casey were to win re-election, this would shore up Pennsylvania's two Democratic seats in the U.S. Senate.
Yeah, and it's a tough map for the Democrats coming up in 2024. They're defending seats in Montana, West Virginia, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Nevada, Wisconsin. So having an incumbent in one of those key states could be a huge advantage for them. Staying in politics now briefly, want to shout out the fact that WHYY is hosting a free open house today at 4 o'clock with about three dozen candidates running for at-large city council seats here in Philadelphia. It's a chance for folks to basically have one-on-one conversations with folks who want to be on city council. There are so many candidates that it's kind of nice to have it in the job fair format where you can meet a bunch of them at once because it is sort of hard to parse through the field. So if you're interested, come on down.
Yeah, and it's from 4 to 7 today. And the event is in partnership with Committee of 70, League of Women Voters, a Philadelphia chapter, and the Philadelphia Inquirer. And now we're going to move to the big news story of today. For the first time in its 250-plus year history, faculty members at Rutgers University are on strike. 9,000 educators, researchers, and clinicians from all three campuses, they're on the picket line. The impact could influence over 67,000 students. WHYY South Jersey reporter Kenneth Burns was on the Camden and New Brunswick campuses on Monday, and he's here with us live. Kenny, welcome.
Thank you.
All right, Kenny, let's jump in. How long has this stalemate been going on between the administration and these three unions? How long have they been talking?
Months. So the contracts for all of the unions, there are 12 unions on the campus, all but one, they all ended in July. So roughly 10 months that they've been at negotiations.
So 10 months of negotiations have led us here to this walkout. What are the main issues that are at stake? What are the unions saying they want that the administration has so far not been willing to give them?
It does circulate around money, but this is one of the more interesting ones. The central message is equity, equal treatment for the workers, particularly your adjunct faculty or part-time lecturers. They are seeking equal payment for equal work. One student I spoke with, his professor mentioned that he makes, as an adjunct, 30% less than your full-time, non-tenured faculty member. So equal pay for adjunct faculty. You also have grad workers. They want a living wage for them. Access to health care for both adjunct and grad workers. They're also seeking a rent freeze for all the properties that Rutgers owns and the cancellation of fees, late fees for students so they could get their transcripts and diplomas. So it's not just about more money for the full-time faculty. In fact, there have been offers that the administration themselves have publicized of what they offer the full-time faculty. But the unions, they want equal treatment among their colleagues and the campuses as well. Because, as you know, Rutgers, New Brunswick, well, let me back up for a second. Yeah. Rutgers is one school with three campuses, Newark, Camden, and New Brunswick, which is the main flagship campus. That New Brunswick campus is a Big Ten school, so keep that in mind.
Yeah.
A lot of the union members have some qualms about how the school has been spending money, particularly when it comes to athletics, even though athletics is standing on its own. But there have been allegations that the school has been focused on athletics more than education. So with all of that said, they just want the priorities reorganized in the and equal treatment among the campuses.
And so let's dig into this a little bit, because I want to talk impact here. I tried to talk about the impact. 67,000 students impacted, 9,000 faculty members, more than half of the faculty on campus. What does this mean for the students specifically with finals coming up?
It depends. If you're a freshman or a sophomore, not so much of an impact. There was one student I spoke with who was actually from Gloucester County. She was in this story this morning that we aired. She is preparing to go to grad school, and those plans are up in the air because the teachers are not working. They're not grading. They're not giving assignments. Classes that she is taking as prerequisites for grad schools, she's in limbo, basically.
Yeah.
So you have those students that are in her situation. Then you have others that are just keeping up with their studies. I know it might be a few years for us since we've gone to college, but you get the syllabus, you do the homework.
Yeah.
And a couple of students I spoke with, they said that they were going to keep up with their assignments because you don't know how long the strike is going to go.
So the latest news, right, is that Governor Phil Murphy and his administration have inserted themselves into the situation in a mediator role in Trenton. I want to play a clip from the governor right now. This is Governor Murphy.
I'm not happy it's gotten to this point. I said this to them, both sides. I am happy that we're able to get in a room together, and I expect a deal that is a fair deal for all parties, ASAP.
And by the way, that's that calm, not happy Governor Murphy voice, for the record.
I mean, and I want to point out the pressure is on. I mean, graduation is weeks away. You got this strike. You know, and this is contagious because Temple University recently had a 6-week strike. They're back at work. And so how long do you think this will last, given what Murphy has said, given that graduation is weeks away? I mean, all of this happening.
The union says they have hope now that the governor is involved with this negotiation. They met in Trenton yesterday. They started at 10 o'clock this morning, and according to the union, they were negotiating all day and all night. It still remains to be seen how soon this will come to a resolution, but all indications indicate they are not there yet. And another thing to point out about the negotiations, Governor Murphy is not directly involved like with state workers, but also you have Chris Christie appointees, the former governor, that are leading the negotiations on behalf of the university.
We do have to leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us, Kenny.
Sure.
That's Kenneth Burns, South Jersey reporter for WHYY News. Coming up on Studio 2, we're talking about alcohol and the risks of even moderate drinking.
How much is safe to consume? Should we change our guidelines? So many questions. Call us with yours, though, about alcohol and your health. Our phone line is open, 888-477-9499, or email studio2@whyy.org, and that's like the number.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You are listening to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. You may be a little confused by the news around alcohol consumption. I know I am. So for years, Cherry, we have heard about the benefits, supposedly, of drinking a glass of wine or having a beer a day. You know, a drink or two a day, we were told, had cardiovascular benefits. And of course, a lot of people seized on that and happily toasted the news.
Including me, Avi. But in recent years, research has found that even moderate amounts of alcohol can be harmful to our health, namely increasing our risk of certain cancers. In fact, Canada recently revamped their guidelines recommending that people drink no more than 2 servings a week. That's significantly less than a lot of us are drinking, right? And that's compared to U.S. recommendations of 1 drink a day for women and 1 to 2 for men.
And there's sort of mixed news on the front of trends. Younger people are drinking less. However, women over 30 have increased their alcohol consumption. So there's a lot to break down. That's why we have brought in University of Pittsburgh epidemiologist Christina Mayer. She's going to join us now to talk about what we know about alcohol's effects on our health, how to think about the risk, and of course, the power of the alcohol industry. And we want to hear from you on this topic. Our number is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. That is 2, like the number 2. So Christina Mayer, thanks so much for joining us on Studio 2.
Thank you for having me.
So, Christina, I want to jump right in. I have to admit, I was shocked to learn that even small levels of alcohol consumption, including red wine, can have negative health consequences when I've been telling myself a glass of wine a day is actually good for me. What does the new research show, and how in the world did we get it all wrong?
That's a great question, and there are a lot of potential answers to that, but I think really like in the 80s and the 90s, this idea that a glass, as you said, a glass of red wine a day was good for your health really took root. And the reality is that we never really had the evidence to support that. There was sort of this idea of what we call a J-shaped curve, so that people who consume no alcohol had slightly elevated cardiovascular risks compared to those who drank, you know, about 1 drink per day. And then the risk then increased after that. However, that evidence was based on observational studies. So we never had sort of the gold standard randomized controlled trial to compare. The idea there is 2 people who have the same baseline risk, one who consumes no alcohol and one who consumes alcohol at a low level. And the reality is that people who do not consume any alcohol may be less healthy than those who drink at lower levels for reasons completely unrelated to their alcohol consumption. So this J-shaped curve, sort of this myth, was really out there. And it was also in the peer-reviewed literature. However, what sort of has become more and more obvious over the years is that even very low levels of alcohol consumption are associated with increased risk for cancer, as you said. And that is at, you know, more than 2 drinks per week, you start to see elevated cancer risk. So even if that J-shaped curve were true, which there really is no evidence to support that finding anymore, we still would not recommend low levels of alcohol consumption since it increases cancer and other risks.
Correlation does not equal causation. And I just want to follow up on something Cherry said. You said the misconception was out there, but how did it get propagated? Like, was the alcohol industry involved in that somehow? Like, there's one thing for there to be a misconception. There's another thing for it to take root.
Yeah, so I think there are, you know, the alcohol industry certainly played a role in this, but it also was really sort of, you know, alcohol has been an important part of American culture since the inception of our nation. You know, the founding fathers used to drink ale every day at lunch. It's played a really important role culturally. And, you know, you think about, for example, college students going off to college. I remember being in high school and sort of assuming that I would, you know, drink alcohol in college. That was an important part of the sort of the college experience. So it's really embedded in our culture. And in the 90s, there was a lot of sort of pointing towards Europe saying, oh, look at the French, look at the Italians. They drink a glass of wine a day. They're healthier than we are. They can handle it. So there was sort of a lot of desire for that moderate alcohol consumption to be, quote unquote, good for you, that came from a lot of different places. And of course, the alcohol industry, you know, it's a $500 billion plus industry per year just in this country. And, you know, they are similar to the tobacco industry. You know, they are embedded across research, policy. You know, they have also, of course, played a role in that.
Everyone wants that Mediterranean lifestyle.
They do. And I want to just I want to talk about the levels of alcohol consumption, because there's levels to everything. How much is too much? And I want you to get specific, because what are the various levels of alcohol consumption? And I want you to define these buckets and then the level of harm associated with each of these levels.
That's an excellent question. So the first thing to sort of start with is when we talk about, you know, a drink serving, people often sort of overestimate how much that is. So for alcohol, for beer, it's a 12 ounce, you know, it's not a 16 ounce pint of beer. We're talking about a 12 ounce serving of beer, and, you know, and a smaller pour of wine than many of us think. So when we talk about a standard drink, first you need to make sure you're thinking about, you know, you can look, there are lots of nice sort of infographics online that can show you exactly how much alcohol of different kinds equals one drink. For cardiovascular risk, as I said, we no longer think that there is any protective effect, but really the, you know, the harmful effect, the increased risk of cardiovascular outcomes starts at about more than 7 drinks per week, so a drink per day. For cancer, it's really estimated that no level is safe, so that's why Canada just changed their guidelines to no more than 2 drinks per day. Alcohol is a class 1 carcinogen. They say that about a drink a day is the equivalent of smoking about 2 cigarettes a day. And you see, even at that moderate, what we call moderate alcohol consumption, which, as you said at the top of this story, is about 1 drink per day for women and 2 drinks per day for men, sort of your increase, your risk, for example, of breast cancer goes up 10% for every drink per day that you consume. So you hear that there really is, you know, no quote unquote safe level, but these are dose response relationships. And so by that, I mean, each additional drink that you have per day does increase risk for many of these health outcomes. And so I mentioned cardiovascular disease, cancer. There, of course, are many other related consequences of alcohol consumption, interpersonal violence, community violence, child abuse and neglect, sort of across the realm, there are lots of sort of acute problems related to alcohol consumption. And with those as well, we sort of see that no level is quote unquote safe or protective, but that risks increase with each drink per day that you continue to consume.
You are listening to Studio 2, and we are talking with Christina Mayer, epidemiologist at the University of Pittsburgh, talking about new research and emerging research that shows the harmful effects of even a moderate amount of alcohol. Our number, if you want to join the conversation, is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. So there was this misconception, Christina, that a little bit of alcohol could even be beneficial to your health. Do you worry at all that we'll go too far in the other direction now and people will be perhaps too puritanical about alcohol consumption?
Quite frankly, I don't see that happening in the context of the United States and okay. our culture. I mean, I guess in theory one could.
It's many years
but,
down
you know,
the road.
I don't think that we... Yeah, exactly.
And so I want to jump in here and bring in a caller. Because you're talking culture, right? I mean, I think about going out with my friends and I gave up alcohol for Lent and I said I wasn't drinking and everybody looked at me like I had 2 heads. So we have Sandra who says, who has a comment. Sandra, tell us what you have to say about your son.
Well, my son and his former girlfriend, recently former girlfriend, are young professionals. He's a detective. She's an assistant district attorney. And they recently broke up because of her alcohol use, which is excessive. And we all traveled together and I had seen it. But he said all of the young professionals he knows, he said drinking is at every event and it's usually at a drinking venue. When they get together socially and during Zoom, they had happy hours, which I thought was healthy in one sense. But almost every day they had a happy hour on Zoom with friends because they couldn't get together. So they'd sit and drink. And they all have like big, beautiful whiskey carts. And, you know, there's a lot of alcohol. And he thinks it's more than maybe it was in previous generations. And I don't know if that's correct, but they're in their 30s.
Yeah.
Can we talk about trends then, Christina?
Yes.
Like, what do the trends say about alcohol use, people of different ages, alcohol use? Where are we heading?
Yeah, so actually we see that Gen Z, sort of this, you know, the newest cohort to be, you know, reached legal drinking age, are drinking less alcohol than any prior generation that we've seen over the past 4 to 5 generations. We've all been sort of surprised to see this and continuing to see this trend, that it actually looks like it is decreasing somewhat. It's a little complicated because there are trends related to your age, and then there are sort of cohort trends, right? Generation Z, Gen Z versus millennials, Gen X, and boomers, because most people drink the most alcohol in their 20s and early 30s, you know, around college and sort of peaking in those early to mid-20s. So, you know, it may appear that millennials are drinking the most alcohol currently. However, if you compare, you know, prior generations at the same ages, alcohol consumption is decreasing slightly. One really important trend to point out, however, are sort of gender differences in this alcohol consumption. So men have always consumed a lot more alcohol than women. You can even hear from the guidelines in the U.S. that it's 2 drinks per day for men and 1 drink per day for women. And we see that sort of women in many circumstances are, quote unquote, catching up to men in their drinking. Mm. So their rates of alcohol consumption are increasing slightly more, sort of catching up to their peers.
And quick follow-up question to that. Did the pandemic impact the amount of drinks that women consumed? Because, you know, there's new cultural phenomenon, you know, wine moms. You know, a lot of women say, you know, a glass of wine in the evenings makes me a little bit nicer to my kids. I mean, is there a cultural shift when it comes to women? And has the pandemic influenced that?
Yes, absolutely. So when the pandemic first started, myself and many other people who study alcohol were really, you know, paid very close attention to what was going to happen with changes in alcohol consumption. And in aggregate, sort of we all drank less, at least in the first 6 months to 1 year of the pandemic. And a lot of that is around the prior caller, what they're talking about, happy hours and, you know, going out to bars and drinking. And we were all at home, obviously, much more than we ever had been before. So in aggregate, those levels went down. One very notable outlier, however, are sort of women in their 30s and 40s around the age of having young children at home. And a lot of that is, you know, drinking to cope and stress and trying to handle work and children at home during the pandemic. So on aggregate, it sort of went down a little bit, but that masks different groups. For example, mm-hmm. young adults drank a whole lot less at the beginning of the pandemic. So some drank less, some drank more. And yeah, this cohort of middle-aged women, certainly that was the group that increased their drinking their most since the start of the pandemic.
Let me reintroduce our guest. We are talking with epidemiologist Christina Mayer about alcohol and your health. I wanted to bring in another caller. Jordan from Wilmington is on the line and has a question specifically about people who used to drink heavily. Jordan, you're on Studio 2.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. my question is, I am a recovering alcoholic. I've been sober for about a year and a half, and before sober, I was drinking very heavily, probably more than 10 drinks per day every day. And I know that when smokers quit smoking, eventually, you know, their risk for all these negative health consequences goes down over time. Eventually, they get to the point where they're on par with non-smokers. So just wondering what the data says about heavy drinkers who quit drinking and how, you know, how long it takes for their risk to go down, and do they ever get back to non-drinkers in terms of health risk?
Christina, can you answer that?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Mm-hmm. I don't think we have sort of perfect evidence to say exactly what that is, but it is similar to tobacco, sort of, so that, you know, once you stop drinking, your risk sort of continues to decrease. It also, of course, depends on what the health outcome that you're looking at is. You know, a known carcinogen and cancer. It depends sort of how long you were drinking, how heavily, how long you have quit. But some of the positive benefits to stopping to drink, you know, do sort of begin to accrue almost immediately. So I would say, given that these are all, once again, observational data, and we don't have sort of like a lab-based randomized controlled trial to really test these things, we don't know exactly how long one has to be sober to sort of get back to that baseline level. But it is sort of, you know, there are some immediate effects and that they continue to sort of, you know, get better over time the longer that one maintains sobriety. So I'm sorry I don't have a more precise answer for you, but it's a really important question. I think it's something that people are continuing to look into.
Yeah, and I want to bring in this email from Bill. Bill says, I have two types of cancer. I reduced my already moderate drinking 3 years ago. I was down to one glass of wine once a week. And when I ran out last October, I simply didn't bother buying more. I don't miss it at all. And when I go out with friends, I found that non-alcoholic drinks are good. Let's talk about this sort of going like abstention, people who abstain, former drinkers who abstain. How successful is, you know, keep telling people just stop? How successful is that?
Well, many people need supports in one way or another to sort of start or maintain sobriety, although it looks very different. Sort of there, we used to think that everyone had to be in, you know, formal alcohol treatment. However, we do see that the majority of people who stop drinking actually sort of do it on their own or in an informal setting. So there's a wide range of ways to, you know, to start and maintain sobriety. I do think that it's getting easier in a social sense to be sober. For example, there are now a lot of bars where there are bartenders or owners who are sober and have created wonderful non-alcoholic drinks. I've noticed in the past year when I go to restaurants, almost every bar or cocktail menu has 2 to 3 non-alcoholic drinks that they sort of put with all of their specialty cocktails. So I think that we are moving towards more comfort and acceptance and non-alcoholic options for people when they go out to social settings where others are consuming alcohol. So there are sort of two very different answers to that question. But, you know, in terms of the, you know, sobriety and being able to maintain that in a bar, I did want to sort of mention that I think that's becoming easier to do.
And then on the public health level, the societal level, what do the solutions look like? Because, of course, we all know at one point in our country's history, we tried to ban alcohol, didn't go so well. So if that's not really a lever we can pull from a policy level, what are the levers we can pull to try to reduce people's alcohol consumption?
Well, I love this question. It's right in my wheelhouse.
This is you. This is you right here.
Exactly. So actually, we have a lot of evidence of things that we can do that work really well. Going to your prior comment about the alcohol industry, they really like to try to paint sort of, you know, reducing alcohol consumption and treatment as an individual behavioral thing only, right? The responsibility is on you as a person who consumes alcohol to make that choice. However, it's really hard to make a, you know, sometimes to make that behavioral choice. So we can change policies and the environment in which alcohol is consumed and accessible. So the less affordable alcohol is and the less accessible it is, the lower, you know, it immediately decreases alcohol consumption in aggregate at the population level. So taxes specific to alcohol are really important.
Like cigarettes.
We saw when we changed the legal drinking age from 21 to 18 and then back again, that makes a big difference. Controlling the number of stores. So Pennsylvania, you know, just recently opened up their alcohol market. You used to have to buy it at a state store and now you can buy it at the grocery store. That increases alcohol consumption and we've seen it over and over again. So there are policy and environmental levers we can pull that reduce alcohol consumption at the population level without sort of fully banning alcohol.
Wonderful. And we are speaking with Christina Mayer, a social epidemiologist and associate professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Pittsburgh. And we're talking about alcohol and your health. We have I want to talk about now a little bit about any benefits. And Robert has a question right now talking about the benefits of possible benefits of alcohol. Robert, you are on Studio 2. Welcome.
Hello. My question is, I work in, I'm a psychotherapist and I work with many psychiatrists and family doctors. And they often will recommend a glass of wine after work to reduce stress and anxiety, especially as opposed to a benzodiazepine or something like that. Is it just your opinion? There's probably no research. I mean, reducing stress is always a good thing. Any thoughts?
Christina, that's for you.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think absolutely, right, for some people, having a glass of wine a day does decrease their feelings of stress, although there, of course, are other things one can do, exercise, meditation, but we all sort of have our own processes that reduce stress. So this becomes a balancing act, right? We know that even that one glass a day of wine will slightly increase your risk of a number of cancers, so you have to think about Is it worth it for me, right? This increased risk. We all do all sorts of things that increase risk somewhat day to day. So I myself drink alcohol. You know, I'm not a sober person myself. So, you know, it's a cost benefit analysis and it can be complicated, but certainly I don't mean to minimize that it can play a really important beneficial social stress reducing role in some people's lives.
Hmm. We only have about a minute left, but I wanted to get your quick reaction to an email from Kelly, who's worried about sweet drinks like hard sodas, boozy cold brew, Sunny D vodka seltzer. Are there any concerning trends you're seeing with the marketing of alcohol? About 45 seconds.
Yes, absolutely. I'll keep it short. There are people who devote their careers to this topic. There absolutely is targeted marketing. Marketing to younger children. Four Loko, for example, was a big problem a while ago. And so, you know, they market to young adults, younger people. You know, there are all sorts of targeted marketing campaigns that happen that are actually, you know, when you look into them, are quite terrifying to see what happens. And so it's a really important problem. Thank you for bringing that up. I will keep it short, you know, because otherwise I don't want it to a very long answer.
So. There's so much we could talk about with this topic, but I do have to say goodbye to our guest, Christina Mayer, professor of epidemiology at the University of Pittsburgh. Christina, thanks for joining us on Studio 2.
Thanks. I enjoyed it.
So coming up, you can tell by the weather, spring is here, and that means it's time to get in your garden if you haven't already. Expert tips from Master Gardener Jenny Rose Carey is up next.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
And right now, WHYY, you are listening to Studio 2. Some great calls and questions that segment. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. So, Avi, are you a gardener?
Absolutely not.
Well, luckily, we aren't asking you for advice instead. We have Jenny Rose Carey, author of The Ultimate Flower Gardener's Guide and the former director of the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society's Meadowbrook Farm. She spoke with producer Debbie Builder about getting your garden ready for summer.
It is finally spring, and most of us are looking out at our flower beds, and they look a little, you know, ragged, covered with dead leaves and sticks. What should we be doing right now in terms of getting our beds, our flower beds, ready for the summer?
Well, actually, it's an interesting time because it's still planning time. You're still trying to work out what you're going to have for the coming season. You can get out to clean up some leaves. I'm never in a real rush to clean up a lot of the leaves. Some of the fallen leaves and some of your dead stems are still going to be hosting overwintering insects. So the more we learn about the life cycles, particularly of our native insects, the more we think, don't be in a real rush to clean them up.
So this is sort of the leaf litter that you're talking about, the dead, pretty dry. If you grab it, you can break it up with your hands.
If you can break it up, that's good, because if you can leave it on there, we're sort of trying to get people to change their aesthetic thoughts about what the garden should look like. And instead of saying it should be neat as a pin, it should be a little bit more organic in nature and a little bit more, not, I don't want to use the term messy, because then that sounds like it's a bad thing, you know, bad connotation. But I also don't like really the clean up your garden, air quotes, you know.
Well, what about moving plants around? I mean, is that something, if we have a lot of perennials, we didn't get to it in the fall, is this a time we can still do that? Is this a good time to do that?
It's really good to dig and divide. If you've got perennials like maybe cat mint or daylilies or something like that, dig off a bit off the side and move it to somewhere or share with a neighbor or a gardening friend. And don't be afraid of digging and dividing. If you've got a big old clump of things, it probably will do better if you dig the whole thing up, sort of pull it apart with either a fork, a shovel, you can't really hurt something like a catmint or daylily or something.
Or like hostas. I think of hostas getting out of control, and you can sort of divide those, right?
Yeah. And actually your garden will look better for it, because you're, especially if you sort of use the same hosta throughout a bed, you know, it's like repetition. It sort of gives you a theme throughout the garden. So from a design point of view, it's a good thing too.
Yeah. And pruning. If something has buds on it, does that mean, you know, leave it alone? Or should we not touch it?
In general, I would leave anything that flowers in spring alone, because particularly hydrangeas, leave them alone. They are going to be flowering on that wood that you see. You can take the dead top of the stick off, but go down to where there's a pear of very nice looking buds. You know, the buds will be either out now, depending where in the listing area you are, or they'll be coming out soon.
I want to ask you about mulch. Should we be mulching? Should we not? As I was driving in, I saw landscapers literally shoving, you know, thick blankets full of mulch around. Is that for, you know, regular gardeners? Do we need to be mulching? And if we do, what kind should we be using? I think people are sort of confused.
Okay, yes, I agree. It seems to be a mid-Atlantic ritual, may we say?
The spreading of the mulch.
The spreading of the mulch. It's like do a few people's backs in while you're at it. I use very little mulch, but I have a very full garden with a lot of self-sowing plants. So you have to look at the type of garden that you're trying to do. If it's mainly trees and shrubs, you know, adding mulch. But don't bother and save yourself some money if you already have an inch or two from last year. Just sort of rake it over and freshen it up. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to save you money on that. Also, don't go too heavily, because if you think about it, sometimes when that mulch lays down like a carpet, it stops water infiltrating through, and you want the water to get to your trees and shrub roots. If you have a, for example, if you grow like a flower bed with zinnias and cosmos and things like that, you can do your mulching, but I would hold off and wait till the soil warms and plant your zinnias and cosmos and marigolds and all of those things, and then mulch around the baby plants. And again, not too deeply.
Mm-hmm. You talked about designing our garden or planning our garden. What advice do you have for people who are just starting out? Maybe they've made a small bed, or maybe they're just thinking about having a few pots. What advice for first-time gardeners thinking about what plants? Do I have shade or sun? What zone am I in?
Okay, let's go. Start with a zone. That's a good prompt. So most of the listing area is somewhere between 5, 6, or 7. Mm-hmm. And you go on the USDA website and you type in your zip code, and then it will tell you what zone you are. That zone will tell you when your last frost date will be, which is useful information, because if you're planting from seed, you sort of work back from that. And most of the listening area will be around Mother's Day, something like that. Work back, and 6 to 8 weeks before that is really when you start a lot of your things from seed. So that's one way of planning, is from seed. The other thing is, if you're just starting off with it, really decide whether you want to grow vegetables, herbs, flowers. You know, what is the purpose of your garden? Is it just for sheer enjoyment? Is it for harvesting things? Do you want cut flowers? So sort of on a piece of paper, just do like a brain dump of why you want to grow something. And then you start thinking, okay, what's the easiest thing to grow? So things like zinnia, you know, who doesn't love a zinnia? Things like that. And then get an old wine barrel or just some old pot and put some zinnias in there, put some basil around it. You know, you can even put a tomato in the middle of it if it's a big enough one. Just start brainstorming. I always call it the wish list. You have the wish list, and then you realize you'll go bankrupt if you actually bought all of those. So then it becomes the realistic wish list.
Absolutely. And you can get caught up in, I should have different textures and different colors and heights and when they bloom. And then you can get kind of overwhelmed, or at least I do.
Yeah, I think it's very easy to get overwhelmed. For most of us, I mean, we like a good summer garden. That's when we tend to be outside. So don't worry about extending the season, you know. And over time, as you garden, you'll develop personal taste. And for me, I have to have a zinnia. That's, you know, I have to have sweet peas. I have to have celosia, which is one of my current favorites. It's the one that they always call the brain flower. But
what
I don't,
does that look like?
It looks like a brain. Yeah, it's crazy. But I like the feathery one. There's three types, the brain one, the plume one, and then the one I like that's called flamingo feather. So I grow that from seed, and it looks really nice with the zinnias in my cut flower vase. So,
yeah,
you know.
Well, that's good advice. Let's talk a little bit about growing vegetables, because a lot of people probably have already doing seeds indoors, getting their beds ready for vegetables. Do you need a different kind of preparation for vegetable beds than for flower beds?
Not really. And as we go back to some of, you know, what's old is new again, and cottage gardens always had vegetables with flowers and flowers with herbs and all of the things. So if you have a raised bed or a large container, all of the things can go in together. You know, they can go in rows, they can go in blocks, or you can interplant them. And also back to, if you have anyone in your neighborhood who gardens, if you know anyone down the street or you belong to a garden club, ask them what they're growing and ask for some starts of any of these things, whether they're vegetables or flowers or whatever. Find yourself a mentor. And that mentor will delight in sharing their things, because gardeners are such sharing people, mm-hmm. you know. So that would be my really, if you're really a beginner or if you want to get to the next level of gardening, find yourself a buddy mm-hmm. or two, three, you know, or do join a garden club or start volunteering at a public garden. Mm-hmm. That's another way to learn.
Well, Jenny Rose Carey, it has been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us on Studio 2.
Oh, thank you, Debbie. Thanks for having me.
Jenny Rose Carey is a gardener, educator, and author. She was formerly the senior director of Pennsylvania Horticultural Society's Meadowbrook Farm. Her books include The Ultimate Flower Gardener's Guide and Glorious Shade.
Well, I think I'll be better than a brown thumb in the future.
Nowhere to go but up for me.
I know. That is it for Studio 2 today. For more of our show, head on over to WHYY.org/Studio 2 and follow WHYY on Twitter. We use the hashtag Studio 2, like the number.
Got to thank three people with big brain flowers.
Yes.
Producers Debbie Builder and Paige Marie Bessler. Our engineer is Diana Martinez. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Thanks for joining us.